become more familiar with your wonderful culture. I've really lost about American history. Big fat books will go out of the library. And one of the things you see there is the importance of the theme of liberty in your culture. Do you understand? You know that, don't you? Yeah, you know, Declaration of Independence and all that stuff, and inalienable rights you've got of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And so I've been thinking a bit about what does that mean for us to have freedom, and how does that affect how we think about God? Because often we think about our interactions with God in one of two ways. One of them we think, maybe you think you've got complete freedom to act autonomously with complete liberty, and you're fully in charge of what goes on. You've got full control. The other way of thinking about it is that God's totally in charge, and you only think you have freedom. After all, he's meant to be sovereign, and he's the creator, and he's all-powerful. So I was thinking about these two options and thinking about, well, where would we stand? We've got a PowerPoint, if you can pop that on. And I went, of course, to the movies and thought about one of the great movies of all time, which should be coming up on screen any moment now. Great movies of all time is The Godfather. Yeah? It is. It's one of the great movies of all time. And you know the kind of iconic image of The Godfather movie, and it has, what I was going to show you was the little picture, of, and it says The Godfather, and there's a picture of the marionette, the kind of the puppeteer hanging down, controlling everything. And that's symbolic of what happens in the movie, of this kind of insidious network of the mafia and how they control people's lives. Obviously, in that context, manipulative and coercive and trying to, get what they want out of it. But in some ways, maybe that's how we view God. Maybe we think God's a bit like the puppeteer, and he pulls the strings on our lives. And we may think we have freedom, but actually, he's the one who's really in charge. Another way of thinking about it is this, and hopefully this does come up on the screen, which was the picture I went back. Oh, there's The Godfather. Okay, and that one there. So here's a picture of Sharon Stone with the Dalai Lama, and she's, those who don't know, she's an actress, and she's a Buddhist and a big advocate for Tibetan rights, and she's got herself into a lot of trouble over the past week because she made some comments on the earthquake in China where she talked about it being bad karma for Beijing's policy in Tibet. And actually, she said these words whilst in Cannes at the film festival there. She said, "I thought, is that karma when you're not nice that bad things happen to you?" Which is interesting philosophy on life. The rock band Radiohead said this. I'll click with this. The rock band Radiohead have a song called Karma Police, and they have these lyrics in there. Karma Police, and it's written about people who upset them, and they call upon the Karma Police to come and get them. So Karma Police arrest this man. He talks in maths. He buzzes like a fridge. He's like a detuned radio. This is what you get. This is what you get. This is what you get when you mess with us. Now, karma is not a Christian idea. Obviously, it's a Hindu and Buddhist one, but nevertheless, I think there's often a Christian version of it, which is basically kind of goes like this. We think God's in charge, he makes all the decisions, and he steers your life. He might reward your good behavior. There again, he's probably going to punish you for your bad behavior, but he's totally in control. He reigns and he rules supremely and unchallengeable, and we're really like pawns who can be sacrificed in his hands. That's one way of thinking about God. Alternatively, you might think of God like this. You might think life is totally our responsibility. You might think it's a place where we have to make opportunities. We have to step up to the plate. A nice American phrase I've learned here. I don't know what it means. There's no free handouts. There's nothing free in life. Life is what you make of it. And if you don't bother to make anything of it, then you have a pretty rubbish time. And that kind of sense of saying God is there, but he's delegated all the choice aspects to you, to us. And to some extent, he's stepped back. He's watching and he's seeing how we do or we don't rise to the challenge. Now, again, this is a well-reasoned worldview. There's great people who've philosophized upon this and written great tomes. And some very profound art house movies have come out on this. None more so than... This doesn't seem to be working. If we can, all right, if you click onto the next picture. There we go. This deeply meaningful movie, Bambi. And... here's the poster, enchanting entertainment for everyone. It says it's bubbling with laughter, tingling with excitement, sparkling with delight. Now then, why is Bambi here? Okay, which is the classic scene in Bambi that you remember? The mum dying, yeah? You all remember that? You remember being traumatised by that when you were 7 years old and all the rest of it? Okay. Little bit of urban myth in that, of course. You never actually see Bambi's mother dying on screen. What you see is Bambi rushing around trying to find the mother, and we realise she's obviously been killed because he doesn't find her. And in fact, Steven Spielberg, no lesser person, described that scene as the biggest tearjerker of all time. Interestingly, if we could click to the next slide, and that's kind of the image we have of Bambi there, wandering around lost and bereft. And in some ways, that's a bit like maybe like how we feel about life. We have liberty, like Bambi discovered, but actually, with liberty comes responsibility and comes a weight that's upon us, and that at times can feel very oppressive, and are dreadful things at times. And so we have this tension between us, this paradox of God is sovereign, he's in charge. On the other hand, we seem to have the ability to be initiators and have freedom and make our own choices. And how do we pull those two things together? And people tend to flip to one side or the other. You'll have a natural instinct one way or the other. Ruth, in this narrative which we heard read, recited there, it gives us, I think, a wonderful overview in story form of how we start to wrestle with this issue, of how we interact with God and how he interacts with us. And I think what we'll end up with is actually a third option. Now, just a quick recap, the story of Ruth, which is fairly early on in the Bible, takes place in about 1100 BC. And it's a time where Elimelech, who's a guy, and his wife Naomi and their sons escape the famine in Israel. They go and their corrupt society, and they go to Moab, which is enemy land. And in this enemy land, Elimelech dies. The sons marry local Moabite girls, and then they die. So it's not a very cheery start. Naomi is broken and penniless and friendless and childless and a widow. And she decides to return back to Israel, to Bethlehem, her hometown. And Ruth, one of her daughters-in-law, decides to stick with Naomi. She identifies herself fully, not only with Naomi, but with Naomi's people and with Naomi's God. And that's what we heard last time. Chapter 1 talks about that. And this is the God of all the earth who Ruth says she's going to follow now. And so the two women are back in Bethlehem, as we heard. They're really at the bottom of the social pile, and they have no source of income. But the chapter begins with a very important piece of narration. The narrator gives us a bit of explanation. And it says this, chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. The name Boaz literally means there is strength, or it can mean a man of valor. And what we're meant to hear, if we were the original hearers of the story, we would have heard that this is probably a soldier, a warrior, a man known for his fighting prowess. You might say, if it was 500 years ago, you might have said he was a knight. Probably someone with great physical strength and courage and nobility. And when you hear that physically, we're also meant to hear that spiritually. He was a godly man, a man of spiritual strength and courage and nobility. He's a man of character. Boaz is a man of standing in the community, a very prominent man in the town. He's great influence in that context. Really, he's like he's got a social title which accompanies the holding of lands. Now, you don't understand that because you're American, so I'm going to give you an English illustration. If we go to the next PowerPoint, skip on from that, sorry, I'm not doing that one. So keep going. So here is a building which was about 20 minutes from where we lived in England. This was our little summer house. Hannah and I just popped down here. And nothing much, really, just a little thing we had and picked up. So this is Chatsworth House, which is, if you go to the next slide, some of you have seen this film. Who saw Pride and Prejudice? The film, yes. Okay. So with Britain's leading wooden actress, Keira Knightley. And it was, so that's set there at, so where they played Pemberley was at Chatsworth House. That's where they filmed it in that area, just near where we lived. Now, the interesting thing is, if you go to the next slide, is this. Here's a map of the UK, and just do one click, and that's where Chatsworth is in Derbyshire. If you do another click, That's Devon. Now, the guy who owns this estate is known as the Duke of Devonshire, even though it's in the middle of Derbyshire. That's where all his lands are. And you think, well, how does this come about? Well, if you click to the next, there's a pint of beer, and it's in London. And what happened was, in 1694, King William II wanted to make the Earl of Derbyshire into the Duke of Derbyshire. Unfortunately, he had one too many of those. And so when this ceremony came around, he got before him, and he said, "I proclaim you the Duke of Devonshire." And, of course, he's the king, so no one can argue with him. So he's now known as the Duke of Devonshire, even though he doesn't live in Devonshire, and it's about 5 days' travel away. And that's how the empire was founded. So that's how Britain became the nation that we are. So now I tell you that long, rambling, digressionary story as a little way of illustrating the fact that in many, many cultures, your name goes with your, and your social standing will go with the lands that you own. And that's how Boaz was. He was a man of standing because he owned these lands, and he would have been known as one of the prominent men of that city at that time. And what's interesting is Naomi, who's poor and destitute, come back from this exile with this foreign daughter-in-law. She's either forgotten about Boaz, or perhaps more likely feels totally unable to approach him. So they're kind of stuck there. But Ruth, who's obviously a woman of great tenacity, this Moabite woman, says this: "Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favour.'" So she doesn't sit around complaining. Instead, Ruth gets stuck in. And what's interesting about the Bible is it always affirms the dignity of work. I don't know if you realise this, there is work in the Bible before the fall happens. Adam and Eve are doing work in the Garden of Eden. Now the fall messes it up. But also we're given a picture in heaven in eternity, we have work there. So in a sense, work is a good thing. It gets messed up because of sin and we get dodgy bosses and all the rest of it. Unless you work for me, obviously, it's a taste of heaven. Work gets messed up in this life, but actually work is something we're inherently wired to do. We're meant to enjoy putting effort in and seeing a reward come from that. So Ruth works, she takes the initiative, and what she does is what's called gleaning. And gleaning is this. Gleaning is when you follow the harvesters and you claim as your own the barley or the wheat, whatever the product is, that's not been cut and hasn't been picked up. And now that may sound a strange thing to our ears, but it works like this. If you go to the next slide, please. There's a verse set further back in the Old Testament in the law, in Leviticus, which says this: "When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God." Now, that's not saying we shouldn't be efficient in how we do agriculture. It's not saying that if you have some fruit trees in your garden, you can't pick them more than once in a season. It's not saying that at all. What it's saying, what we need to understand is how the Old Testament is written. This is a little digression now. The Old Testament law, like Leviticus, comes in three forms. One is moral law, which applies at all places and all times, like don't murder. One is ceremonial law, which is really about how we have a right relationship with God. And that's where all those blood sacrifices and guts and everything all come in there. And since Jesus came, he, in a sense, rewrites those. And he is the one who fulfills all those and points us forward to how we can have a right relationship with God. But the Old Testament stuff gives us pointers for understanding new depths, the fullness of who Jesus is. But then the third type of law is what you could call civil law. And this is an example of that. And civil law is this. It's about how we live and create a just and a fair and a good society. And what we need to do is see the principles of the operation there. The principle that is there in this verse, and it's there in the Old Testament, is we should care for the poor. That's the principle. Now, how that works out in particular cultures is always going to change and develop, because most of us don't have fields which we own and we don't go out reaping. So for us, this doesn't make any sense. But what we do is we take the principle. The principle is we should care for the poor. The way we interpret that in 21st century urban culture is it's about our attitudes. It's about how do we respond when we encounter the poor, say, when you're shopping. It's about what we do with our money. It's about how we make our decisions about who we vote for. It's those kind of issues that this is speaking to us about today. So that's the kind of little digression on what that's saying there. So the principle in the Old Testament is care for the poor. In a culture where you have fields where you manually go through with a scythe and cut the harvest, it says just go through once, because people will come behind you, the poor and the bereft and the aliens, and they'll be able to come and pick up what you miss, and they'll be able to survive on those leftovers, on those things that you left behind. We've got a picture here, and this is one from about 150 years ago by a French painter called François Millet. And it was a picture of France at that time, of the same thing, of gleaning going on. And so even though that's a fairly contemporary picture, it's very much wouldn't have changed over those 3,000 years in between. So it's backbreaking work. It's competitive. There'll be other people there fighting for the same good stuff. It's not an easy way to make a living. Really, you're competing for the scraps. But if you work hard, you can just about get by. But it really is not an easy way to live. And that's what Ruth is entering into. That's what she chooses to go and do. Not an easy way of living, but she has the tenacity to get stuck in. In fact, we hear later the foreman says just how hard she's been working. But then this happens. The Bible says this. She's out in the field working, and then this little phrase says, as it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who we've talked about. And when we hear, as it turned out, we're meant to go, aha. It's kind of a bit like saying, as luck would have it, or fancy that. Goodness me, she's in Boaz's field. Whoa, good Lord, how did that happen? Well, that's how we're meant to hear it, okay? So it's kind of a little kind of nudge and a wink there, and it's like, something's going on here. She thinks she's just wandered into a field, and she's gleaning, but aha, God's really at work behind the scenes. And he's pulling the strings. He's making something happen here. He oversees everything. He allows everything to happen. Sorry, his blooming microphone keeps falling off my ear. And he allows the bad stuff of life, like we've heard about death in the first chapter of Ruth, but also he steers us for the good stuff of life as well. And here, very, very strongly implied is this, that this is God's plan and God's steering. Ruth thinks she's initiating, but God's really the one who's making the plans. We've got a little verse here we're going to see on the screen, if you pop it up. This is for my poker-playing buddies as well. You'll enjoy the picture. And in Proverbs 16, it says this, the lot is cast into the lap, but as every decision is from the Lord. And that's taking the same theme, which is, we may think things happen randomly, but actually, God oversees everything. Even something as random as throwing dice or playing cards or whatever it is. And so for here, something more significant than that, Ruth trying to work out how she's going to earn some money, how she's going to make a living, God is in the mix of that as well. Then what happens is Boaz appears on the scene and he greets his workers in a very kind of with this kind of mutual blessing. He says, the Lord be with you. And they say, the Lord bless you. And it's more than just a social greeting. It seems to be like for Boaz, faith is very natural for him in his workplace, even on the shop floor. He's got a friendly rapport with his workers. And he looks around and he sees all these people and he sees Ruth. He doesn't recognize her. He says, whose family is she in? And that's a cultural way of expressing things, because in that culture at that time, life outside a family was almost unthinkable, it was almost impossible. So he's inquiring about her, not because he wants to exclude her, but because he's concerned for her welfare. And don't forget, this is a country which has recently had massive spiritual famine and physical famine. It's not a safe place for a young, single, attractive girl who's from a foreign country. And so he finds out who she is, and he goes to her and says, look, stay with my servant women. My men, they're not going to mess with you. And he says it kind of very euphemistically, but it's about sexual protection for her, physical protection for her, so she won't be violated in any sense. And he says, you can also drink freely from the water we've got. We think, what's the big deal about that? Well, again, there's not running water in this culture. This is water which has been drawn from the well laboriously by hand, carted to the field just for the workers to use, not for the gleaners. And he says, look, you can access this as well. You don't have to go and disappear for a mile to the town well and take your turn in the line and pull it up and then come back 2 hours later. You can just use that stuff we've got there. And he's saying, you know, I want you to feel free to pick up the stuff that's there and all this rest of all that stuff you heard about. And Ruth is amazed to be so treated. She's amazed by this. And she has this very humble response to Boaz. And it's a bit like and this humble response that, where she's kind of responding to him like a lord, it, in a sense to us, sounds a bit strange. But really, it's like this. Imagine you move to a new city and you can't find a job. You search and search and search for a job. Eventually, you get offered one day's work as a temp in an office. And you get in and you think, well, I might as well work hard. So you start working hard. At lunchtime, the boss meets you and he walks across to you and he offers you triple wages for the day. And he says, oh, by the way, come to the executive lounge and enjoy a nice dinner there. We've got barbecue, barley bread and vinegar and oil to dip into. And he says, in fact, more than that, I know you've signed up for a day, but I'm going to give you ongoing work. And I'm going to give you a full benefits package and a parking space and a free tank of gas. That's kind of what Ruth experienced when Boaz interacted with her. And as a stranger, you'd go, why are you doing that to me? I've got no right for such care. And in fact, the phrase she says is really can translate as, why do you take notice of me when I'm not worthy of notice? But Boaz says he already knows who she is. He knows her story. Once he knew her name, he could identify her. He knows her story. He knows that she's been faithful to her mother-in-law, and in fact, of course, to his extended family. And he speaks this lovely blessing over Ruth. He says, may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to find refuge. And he uses the special name of God, which is, he says the Lord in English, but actually it's Yahweh in the Hebrew, which is the covenant name of God. And don't forget, covenant is all about two becoming one, us uniting. So covenant between us and God is us uniting with God. Everything that we have, we give to him. Everything that he has, he gives to us. It's called the deal of the century. And so that's what covenant is all about. And really he's saying, may the covenant-keeping God embrace you into his covenant. But everything that he has, he gives to you. And it's a wonderfully rich blessing to offer to her at this time. And Boaz tells his workers again to increase the blessing. He says, leave extra barley out for Ruth. And at the end of the day, they get to the threshing floor. And they start to beat the useful stuff from the inedible stuff, because obviously the inedible stuff is no good for them. So they beat it in the two, and you get the two piles. You have the one pile, which is the good stuff from the harvest, and they take that away and bag it up and use it for cooking. And they've got the bad pile, which is all the husks and the stalks and the twigs, and they bag that up and send it to Kellogg's and use it for all bran. And And Ruth goes home with this massive, massive amount of all the good stuff from the harvest, way more than anyone could possibly expect to get from a day's gleaning. And can you imagine how she's feeling at that moment? Can you imagine the sense of relief that she has? She's thinking, goodness me, I picked a good field there. And got, you know, a little smile on God's face at that point. And she's a woman who's widowed, who's exiled from her own land, who's with a strange people and with strange customs and a foreign language. I know how that feels. No, I don't. And she's come to Israel, and she's there facing grinding poverty. She's an alien with a funny accent, and she's stuck in this place, doesn't quite know how to get on with everyone, and yet she's been overwhelmingly blessed. So that's the narrative. What are we meant to see from that? Just a couple of things. Let me finish off here by pointing out a few things we can take from that. What are we meant to see? Well, we're meant to see several things. First of all, we're meant to see that Boaz himself is going to be the one who God particularly uses to bring a fulfillment to the blessing he's spoken. So Boaz has spoken a blessing over her, and actually he'll be the one who helps bring that fulfillment into her life. And we'll see that next week with the end of chapter 2 and chapter 3. We're also meant to see God's provision for Ruth and for Naomi, that this didn't all happen by chance, and even if it will take time and perspective for them to realise this, God is actually at work in Ruth's life. God is actually at work in Naomi's life. Third thing we're meant to see is this. Boaz and how he deals with Ruth is actually a picture of how God deals with us. He deals with us with kindness, with blessing, with provision. He honours our best efforts. He guides us in our small steps as we learn to follow his voice. Sometimes it's a quiet voice because he wants us to learn to listen to him. But as we learn to listen to his voice, he can open up all sorts of amazing opportunities and blessings in our lives. God is a God of who loves when we bring the little that we can do, and he breathes in it and turns it into something amazing. You know, it's like those, we all interact with young children, and when a young child brings you that little picture they've drawn, and you say, you make the wise decision, which is to say, what's this? Rather than trying to describe what it is, because you've no idea what it is, of course. So you have to say, oh, what's this? And they go, oh, it's a picture of you, Daddy. You go, thank you so much. And, you know, but it's precious and treasured because, you know, they've done it and they've given their very best of you and they've drawn you with, you know, 3 ears and one eye and seven digits on each hand, all the rest of it. But, you know, it's precious and it's wonderful. And you don't go, you silly child, you know, I've only got 5 fingers, why have you drawn me with 7? You're pleased because they've done their very best and they've given it to you. And you receive it in that spirit. It's exactly the same with God, with us. We do our best compared to him. He's created the whole universe. What can we possibly have to show him that's of any value? What can we possibly show him of any value? And yet he's thrilled, he's delighted when we bring our best, when we work with him, when we try hard, when we're creative and we use all the good things that he's put into us. You know, we are created in the image of God. And what that means, we have the thumbprint of God upon us, his handprints all over us. He's breathed into us his something of his nature and his character. And that means there's both an awesome responsibility and an awesome glory within each one of you. You see, God's chosen to give us freedom of will. In other words, we can make genuine choices. We can make meaningful moral and practical decisions. And that's what distinguishes us from all the other animals, all the rest of creation. And yet the amazing thing is the sovereignty of God, the glory of God, is not diminished by our freedom. In fact, the reverse, it's deepened. Creation's summit is people who possess wills that choose to love God. And we can choose to love him or to hate him. We can choose to love one another or hate one another, to serve or to take, to obey or to disobey. And you know, true sovereignty is neither controlling nor random. In fact, it allows other wills. And so I think the third alternative is this. We have a sovereign, all-powerful God, and we are at the same time empowered and able to take the initiative. And the two meld together. And as they meld together, you get this explosion of life and hope and possibility. You know, it's not either or, but it's both and. There's a little phrase which you might have heard, which is along the lines of, work like it's all down to you, believe like it's all up to God. And it's kind of, there's two things in juxtaposition there. So let me completely finish now by giving us a response to think about as we go from here. And I think the response is this. We will each have a natural tendency, one way or the other, in how we interact with God. Some of us will have a tendency to be too independent from him. We like being independent from God. We kind of ignore his blessings in our lives. We ignore his goodness to us, or we kind of take it for granted, perhaps, is a nice way of putting it. We fail to recognize his initiative in our life. But you know what? Someone said earlier, we can't take our next breath without his express permission. And sometimes we need to remember that. Everything in life comes from him, and everything returns to him, and it only makes sense in the light of him. So for those of us who have a tendency to be too independent from God, the challenge from Ruth's story is to recognize that actually we're totally dependent upon him. And there's nothing we can do without him. And for others of us, we have the opposite tendency. And that tendency is to be too slow to take the initiative, too reluctant to pick up our responsibility. There's a saying which I remember I heard way back in the past of my life, which was this: God may feed the birds, but he doesn't throw the worms into their nests. And I think there's a thing of this, that we can have a tendency which expresses itself in fear of risk, in wanting everything nailed down 100% certainly before we move forward, being permanently discouraged by past failures. And you know, that's not how God wants you to live either. And if that's more your tendency, I think God would want to say, be willing to take risks. Be willing to step out and try some things. Be willing to just try some stuff out. And yeah, sometimes you will mess up. It's not all going to go 100%. But you know what? It doesn't always matter. It's okay. try some stuff, take some risks. So I think we will have one with the other that you naturally swing towards. And what we need to learn to do is have a response like Ruth has, which was bringing the two together, melding them together. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give us a moment's silence just to allow you to collect your thoughts and just think, well, which way am I going with this? How can I, what things do I want to take into my week ahead and how I'm going to behave and think? And I would encourage you also, as you think about that, think, who are you going to be accountable to for this? So if you're going to say, for instance, you know what, I'm going to be more intentional about recognising God's hand in my life and thanking him for it, well, who's going to hold you accountable for doing that? Or maybe you're saying, I'm going to take the decision to be more of an initiative taker, to use what God's put in my hands for his glory, not just wait passively till everything's perfect before I step out. Well, again, who's going to hold you accountable for doing that? So I want you to think about that, and then I'm going to pray for us. So I'll just give you half a minute to be silent before God, and then I'm going to pray.